Well, this morning we're, as I mentioned in 2 Kings chapter 4, when we think about the divided kingdom, it's not a period of time of history for God's people that we think of as the pinnacle of their faithfulness. It's a period that's rather dark, especially when we think about the northern kingdom and their descent very quickly into apostasy. There are some bright spots, and that's where we're going to be looking this morning, at one of the bright spots. We think about where we've been focusing our attention. In the seat of power, we've been looking at Ahab, and we've seen his rule, Jezebel's influence on the kingdom, and his son Ahaziah. And how would you characterize them as people? How would you characterize their attitude toward God? Very good. It's hostile. They look at God as an obstacle to them getting what they want. They look at God as an enemy. They look at his prophets as enemies. And so, just complete obstinance against God. So this morning, when we look at these accounts, what we're going to begin to see is that among the people, though, there are pockets of faithfulness. There are very much bright spots among the people. We'll see that there are groups of men who fear God. And these are spread out in the cities of the kingdom. We'll see that there are individuals who are devoted to God, and they're doing what they can to be faithful to God. And we see God continuing to pour out his power, and it's refreshing for us to see this. And we'll even see that God, through these miracles of Elisha, will be magnified more among the Gentiles, foreshadowing God's attempts through Christ to bring even the Gentiles to himself. When we think about the accounts that we're going to be studying today, we love these stories. They're real events, and when we look at them, we are amazed and we are encouraged. Now, think for a moment what the impact would be on those who were contemporary with these events. They also, and we'll see indications of this as we study today, that they loved these accounts, and they were familiar with the people. They were still around. And we'll see that even a wicked king is curious about these things. He's asking about them. And so the point of all that is that God's efforts to bring his people to himself are having their fruit. There are faithful among, even in wicked Israel, who is destined for captivity. God has made inroads with them. There are those among them who are becoming more faithful. And another indication of that, before I move on, we'll see that these sons of the prophets, not only are they scattered out amongst the people, but in the cities there through the land, throughout the land, but they are also living openly. And even Elisha, it has a house in Samaria, we learn in chapter 6, verse 32. He's moving about freely, so very differently than Elijah, who seems like he was always on the run, always, in the shadows, not able to move openly so much among the people. So these are indications of more faithfulness and a change in the conditions from some of that hostility. It's not ultimately going to result in them renewing the covenant and being truly faithful to God, but there are among the people those who are. And our first account here this morning, the widow. She comes to Elijah and she says to him, my husband is dead. You know him. He was one of the sons of the prophets. And he was a man who feared God, one who was seeking the will of God. And he's dead. I have incurred a debt. I can't pay it. They're coming to take my two sons. And this was in Leviticus chapter 25, verses 39 and 40. This was something that was allowed by the law of Moses, for them to take them not as slaves, but as servants. And then in the year of Jubilee, if they weren't redeemed, they were to go back and to be free. And so that's what's happening here. It was, you know, we might even look at that, by the way. I think this was probably mentioned when we studied through the law. But this even was a provision for a debt to be settled and for someone to be, to work and to have food and shelter. So it was, even this was a provision for them. And so, but it's a very, it's a very extreme provision, and it's going to be a hardship on this widow. So she appeals to Elisha. And Elisha asks her the question, what do you have in your house? And she says, and the implication, I think, is, you know, what do you have in your house that may be of some value that you could sell and settle the debt? And the woman seems to answer with that in mind, if that wasn't what Elisha meant. She answers, I have nothing of any value except this small cruse of oil. Killen Dillich points out that this is a flask. This is a small flask of anointing oil. Precious, valuable, a very valuable and easily traded commodity among the people. But it's not much. Her problem isn't that it's not valuable, it's she doesn't have much of it. So even if she were to go sell it, it's not nearly enough to settle the debt. So Elisha says, go borrow vessels, jars, pots, whatever you can get. Not just a few, you borrow bunches of them. And so, and he tells her what's going to happen. He says, when you got them in your house, shut the door, and you and your sons only. You take these pots and you take this flask of oil and you fill them. So she understands that what he is saying to her is, this is going to be a miracle. She understands that this flask could never fill those pots. So she goes out in faith and does that. You can just see the neighbors like, what do you need with all these pots? Never mind. Shalom. Peace. I need them. Brings them back to the house. They begin. So can you think of the anticipation as they, you know, she knows what the prophet has said will happen. And so she has that flask and she begins to pour it. The sons are looking on in anticipation. And what would normally happen is you pour and there's a little puddle in the bottom of a bigger pot. Nothing more. But as she turns, it continues to flow, and it flows, and it flows. And by, this pot is full. Large pot from a small flask. So they see the prophet is true. The miracle is blessing. God is helping. And so another pot is brought, and another pot, until they've got pots scattered around full of this very costly or this expensive oil, valuable oil. She calls for another one, and there are no more, Mom. And so the oil stops. Now, I think one of the most fascinating aspects of this story, obviously the miracle is remarkable, but it's what the woman does next. It isn't that this woman doesn't recognize the value of this oil, or the ease with which she could sell it. She goes back to the prophet. She came and told the man of God. So do you see that she's not presumptive? She could have easily deduced, and certainly did understand, I can go sell this oil, pay the debt, and me and my son can live on the rest. But she's not so presumptive as to, God may have another plan for this oil. So she goes back to the prophet, and then he tells her, yes, go sell the oil, pay your debt. And you and your sons live on the rest. Any comments before we move on from this story? That faith that, and another lesson I think we can gather from a lot of these stories is that God is caring for his people in these small things. And of course these stories will be spread abroad. It will increase the faith of many. But God cared about this woman. Her husband was faithful. No doubt she was faithful as well. And God cares about her. That was enough. It's a good point. It's a good point that you think about Deuteronomy chapter 8 verse 3, for example. What does the Lord say there? I allowed you to suffer hunger that you might learn to trust me. And so that's a lesson that they needed to learn. And that's a lesson that we need to learn, that there are times in our lives when there's difficulty that we face, that it is for our benefit. It is through many trials that we must enter the kingdom of heaven, Acts 13. So the next story, was there another comment? Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just thinking as you were saying that, what you're no doubt thinking about is the account when the king is told to shoot the arrows and to strike the ground. why did you only strike the ground three times? It was just a manifestation of, I mean, he had already been shown an indication. The arrow goes out the window. Ah, God is doing something symbolic here that's going to have very real ramifications. Wham, 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 just three. It's like, really? You would have destroyed the Syrians. But it was a manifestation of a lack of faith. All right, so we're going to be looking at this area around Shunem, where the Shunem is a city that still exists today by a different name, Salim. But this area is just to the south and west of Mount Moreh. It's, in fact, I've got a picture here. This is from Mount Moreh, looking out across the, they're in the valley of Jezreel here. This valley of Jezreel runs in this way. This is the plain of Esdraelon. So when we're looking at this right here, that's what we're seeing. You can see the patchwork of fields here. We recognize that this is a heavily agricultural place even today. And just beautiful area here that the Shunammite was from. And so Elisha comes to this area. He's traveling about. And the Shunammite invites him in to have food. And Elisha comes in, has food. And no doubt she makes this an open invitation to Elisha. And so whenever he's coming through that area, he stops in there and gets food. Well, the Shunammite woman is thinking about Elisha and his needs. She thinks about him as a person. He's passing through here. What can I do for him? So we see her compassion. We see her faithfulness and her generosity. She says to her husband, please let us make an upper room on the wall, verse 10, and let us put a bed for him there and a table and a chair and a lampstand. So it will be that whenever he comes to us, he can turn in there. Very considerate. And so this is done. And Elisha and his servant, they come through that area. They use this very gracious accommodation. Well, Elisha, too, is thinking about the Shunammite woman. He's thinking about, well, she's shown us all this kindness. What can be done for her? And so he has Gehazi call her. She comes to him, and he speaks through Gehazi and says, what can we do? Would it be good for you if I bring a message on your behalf to the king or to the commander of the army? She says, I dwell among my own people. I don't really have a need for that. So she's dismissed, but evidently Elisha and Gehazi, they continue to talk about this, and Gehazi strikes upon the idea. Wait, she has no son. Her husband is old. And so Elisha says, call her back. And he says to her, about this time next year, you shall hold a son. You shall embrace a son. Well, she is overwhelmed. This is more than she could have even dreamed. She says, don't give me false hope. Don't deceive me. I don't think this is so much a manifestation of no faith, but more of just the overwhelmed by the size of the offer and just, you know, wondering how such a thing could be. But certainly the Israelites knew of an account. They could think back to Sarah and Abraham. And so he tells her this, and this is going to be an occasion again for faith to be built among God's people there. And so she says to him, do not deceive me in this situation. So the child does come. He is born and grows, and he's in the field, probably some of those very fields we just looked at, with her husband, and he cries out, my head, my head. And so the man sends, one of the servants sends the child to be carried, so he's not very old, carried back to his mother. And the child sits on his mother's lap until noon and then dies. Now, the Shunammite woman's faith, I think, here is on high display, because what is the normal behavior that you would have in this situation? Well, normally you would send a message back to the father, your son is dead. We need to prepare for the burial. She does neither. She takes the child and lays him back on the bed, on Elisha's bed. And she does go out to the husband and says, let me have now one of the young men and a donkey. We're going to go to the man of God today. Why today? It's not new moon. It's not a Sabbath. Now there's an indication in that this woman did go to the man of God on these appointed days of worship. She was someone who was faithful. So we get an insight into her life. Her normal life was to go and to worship. And the husband recognizes this. But why today? She says to him literally, shalom. It is peace. Don't worry. And so she tells the young man, the donkey and the young man is provided. And she says, don't slacken your pace unless I ask you. Let's go quickly. So they go. And as she's going, Elisha and Gehazi, they're on Mount Carmel. They look. They see her at a distance. She's coming. And they recognize her. So Elisha says, go out and meet her. Ask her, is all well with her husband, with her child, with her household. And so he goes out, and the woman, here comes Gehazi, and is all well. Shalom. It is peace. She continues on. But when she gets to Elisha, she falls down at his feet, and she is so distraught. Did I say, don't deceive me? Did I ask a son? And so by this, Elisha knows, he knows that this is, that the son, something has happened. And so he tells Gehazi, take my staff, run. If someone greets you, do not greet them. Do not get tangled up in a long conversation. You get over there, lay this staff on the face of the child. So Gehazi does this. The woman, meanwhile, says, I will not leave you. So they begin the journey over to Shunem as well. Gehazi gets there, he lays the staff on the child's face, nothing happens. No word, no hearing, no voice. So Gehazi begins the journey back to meet Elisha and the Shunammite on their journey to Shunem. And he tells them what has happened. And so Elisha and the Shunammite woman get there, and then we see Elisha go up to the upper room where the child is, and he lays there on the child. And the child's flesh becomes warm. He goes down. Now, before this, I should point out that the most important thing he does before he ever even lays on the child is he prays to God. Then lays on the child. The child's flesh becomes warm. He goes back down to the room, the house, that is, walks about, goes back up, lays on the child again. And this time the child sneezes the 7 times, opens its eyes, and the Lord... Oops, I've gotten behind here. So the child is alive. Elisha says to Gehazi, call the Shunammite woman. So he called her, verse 36, and when she came in to him, he said, pick up your son. So she went in, fell at his feet, and bowed to the ground. Any comments before we move on? You see that these stories, again, they will be, in fact, this is the story that the king in chapter 8, verses 1 through 6, that he's going to be hearing about. So even this wicked king, fascinated by these things, interested, intrigued. Well, there is a time of famine upon the land. Again, chapter 8, verse 1 tells us that this was a famine that would last 7 years. And this is probably about the time when Elisha would have told that Shunammite woman to leave the country, to go wherever she might, to be able to provide for her family. So Elisha returned to Gilgal, and there was a famine in the land. So he was with the sons of the prophets. And, of course, they had great need. And food, provisions, shelter, as we see from these stories, is a constant concern, a constant pressure that they're dealing with. So Elisha says to his servant, notice that it's not Gehazi that he's talking to here, but he says, put on a pot. We're going to make a stew. And so they gather, they go out into the fields, and they begin to gather whatever wild vegetables that they might be able to find. And they find something it's been identified most likely as a colocynthus. It's kin to a cucumber. It's a gourd-like, vegetable, but it is very bitter. If you eat it in small doses, it will cause colic and will begin to affect the nervous system. But if it's taken in larger doses, it can kill you. So very likely this is what they've gotten. They don't know that. So they slice it up in the pot. you know, times are hard. They're not too picky until the stew is ready and they serve it and they taste the bitterness and they perceive, no, this is not good. So they cry out, man of God, there's death in the pot. And Elisha says, bring me some flour. And he put it into the pot and said, serve it to the people that they may eat. And there was nothing harmful in the pot. So again, we see God providing for his people. We see him providing for these men who are trying to be faithful. Well, shortly thereafter, it seems, there was a man from Baal Shalisha. I don't have a map for this. I should have. But if you can imagine where Bethel is, kind of there in the hill country of Ephraim, if you'll go due west of there, this is Shalisha, that whole area. Baal Shalisha was a city in that district that was fairly prominent. So what we have here is a man bringing to Elisha, to the sons of the prophets, those who are faithful in the land, what would have normally been brought to the Levites, if indeed this is him bringing the first fruits as commanded in the law. But he is, you see the faithfulness of this man. We're in a famine. How hard is it for this man to take food, the first fruits, and bring it and give it away during the middle of a famine? Pretty tough. So you see the faithfulness of this man, even in this wicked country. And he says, give it to the people that they may eat. Well, there's a problem. The man brought it, as you can see here, in a knapsack. And these are not big loaves of bread like, you know, like we get in the store that you could feed. Even if you just ate the bread, it might not be that nutritious, but it would be a fair amount of food. These were small loaves. And so it wasn't nearly enough to feed 100 men. But he says, give it to the people that they may eat. And as he says this, shall I set this much before 100 men? Do it. They will have plenty to eat, and there will be some left over. Well, they did. They had plenty of food left over. And again, this is one of those miracles, I think, that foreshadows some of the miracles that Jesus will do. And so, again, we see God providing for his people, those who are his. Any thoughts before I move on into the story of Nahum? I recognize, and Matt and I both recognize, we're doing this at about double pace. The fastest I've ever covered the divided kingdom is 2 quarters. We're doing it in 1. So I encourage you to study as much as you can at home. Make comments in class. I apologize when I sometimes get maybe a little bit, I get to thinking about we've got to make territory. So please forgive me for that. And if you have any comments, make them. If we don't get to all the stories, we'll just have to study them at home. All right, so Naaman. Here we're going to see an account where God is demonstrating his power not only to the children of Israel, but to the people who are in other lands, and most notably Syria. Syria is an adversary of the people of God at this time, throughout this period of history. Well, what we see about Naaman is he's a leper, but he's a man of valor, and his master, the king, is very pleased with him. He thinks very highly of him. Now, one thing that kind of sticks out in our mind is, how is a leper there with the king? If this were in Israel, would that be the case? Right, shouldn't have been. But this is Syria. They have no compunction. They have no law that would say anything about this. So it's possible for him to hold a place of high rank and to be esteemed among the people. But it is a dreadful malady. And so notice, too, that the Lord is giving victory to Syria. We see, again, that God is using different techniques, different ways, measures to get Israel back. We see the famine. We mentioned Amos chapter 4, giving them cleanness of teeth. Why? So that you'll return to me. You didn't, but that's what I was trying to do. Well, here we see that the Syrians are oppressing Israel through this man Naaman that God is using, and they are having success. The fact that this little Israelite girl is there as a maiden servant is testament to the fact that they had been successful in their raiding. God is allowing that to happen. And so she's there, but notice she has faith. Oh, that my master were with the prophet in Samaria. That's where Elisha was. Again, that's, I find that striking. Elisha has a house in Samaria. He's there in Samaria as a rule. And she says, oh, that he were with him. He could heal him of this leprosy. Well, the king gets word of this, and they put together a tremendous amount of treasure. 750 pounds-ish of silver, 150 pounds of gold, 10 changes of clothing. Sends him to the king of Samaria with a message. Heal my servant. Well, when he gets to Samaria and the king gets this message, he tears his robe. He's distraught. He don't, am I God to make alive, to kill? I can't do this. Well, Elisha evidently is there in Samaria at this time, and he hears this message and he goes, send him to me. Again, a manifestation of the lack of faith of the king. Do we have no resources? Do I know nothing of the power of God being poured out among God's people here? He doesn't think of that. But Elisha says, you should have thought of that. Send it to me and he'll know there's a God, there's a prophet in Israel. And of course the prophet has no power if there's not a God in Israel. And so that's the conclusion that Naaman's ultimately going to draw. Yes, sir.
What does that say about Naaman?
Good comment. Thank you. That's right. Very good. Yes, sir. Right. It just shows the mindset. God's not an aid to his people. He's an adversary. And that was the prevailing mindset that they had at this time. So he is brought to Elisha, but Elisha, as opposed to going out and seeing this great man with this great amount of wealth and with his retinue that was with him, he sends a servant out and says, go wash in the Jordan, go dip 7 times. Well, Naaman is very offended at this. He says, I said to myself, he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and heal the leprosy. So we see here the contrast between man's thinking and God's thinking. When we demand of God to do things our way, that's never a good thing. When we're presumptive, that's never a good thing. But he does this, and so he leaves furiously. And he leaves what else? He leaves a leper. And this has been a waste of time as far as he's concerned. But one of his servants has got a cooler head and says, my Lord, if the prophet had asked you to do some great, great thing, you would have been eager to have done it. You would be eager to do this thing. How much more if he comes to you with a small thing and says, dip and be clean? And so Naaman is persuaded. You know, he had argued about the Arbana and the Pharpar being better rivers. They are. I mean, in terms of just clarity, the Jordan is very turbid. These rivers are clear. They flow out of the mountains very clearly. Beautiful rivers. But he goes down to the Jordan and he dips 1 time, a leper, 2 times, a leper, 3, 4, 5, 6 times, still a leper, 7th time. And his flesh is restored like that of a child. And he is completely healed. Well, Naaman comes back to Elisha and he is eager to give to him gifts from what he had brought. But think about Elisha's response. No, the Lord is not for hire. You know, I think about Simon in Acts chapter 8. That's not the message here. God is not doing this for reward. God is doing this to magnify his name. And so Elisha denies that request to receive these gifts. Well, Naaman, satisfied with that answer, asks for 2 mule loads worth of the soil there so that he may go back to Samaria or to Syria, and that he would be able to set up an altar there where he would worship only the Lord. He says, indeed, now I know that there is no God in all the earth except Israel. So we see here that God's intent, the message was received loud and clear. Naaman understands that. This will have, no doubt, some impact back in Syria, showing God's people by foreshadowing that God does too care about the Gentile as well, and he will ultimately join them together in Christ. Well, Gehazi is not satisfied with this. He sees this, well, the prophets, these people that are righteous, had they been suffering want? Yeah, we've just read some stories about that. They're suffering poverty, want. And Gehazi sees this as an opportunity to solve that problem, at least for himself. And so notice what he says here. He invokes the name of the Lord. As the Lord lives, Jehovah lives. That just seems so ironic. Evidently, he's thinking this thought to himself. As Jehovah lives, I will run after him and I will take something from him by deception, by the way. So he goes and he catches up to Naaman. And Naaman sees him coming, dismounts, faces him, talks to him. Well, he lies. He comes up with this lie. There are two sons of the prophet have just arrived from the hill country of Ephraim, and would you give them a talent of silver and two changes of clothes? Well, Naaman's very willing to do this. He's eager to do this. He would have dispensed with all that he had brought with him. He's so overjoyed at being healed. Well, so he says, would you take two talents? Well, Gehazi, that sounds good. I'll send some servants with you to help you carry them. That's a lot of silver. 150 pounds of silver, two changes of clothes. He goes back to where Elisha's house is, hides this wealth. Evidently, he's thinking about, as he goes back, at least this is my take on it, he's thinking about what he's going to do with it. And Elisha then says to him, when he comes back in, he's trying to act like nothing's happened. Where did you go? Oh, I didn't go anywhere. Did my heart not go with you whenever the man turned back? And because of this, you'll be a leper, and not just you. The leprosy of Naaman will cling to you and to your descendants. And he left from his presence as white as snow. Naaman had demonstrated some faith and was cleansed. Gehazi demonstrated faithlessness in this deceptive plan, and he was not blessed. He was defiled by it. Any comment before we move on to this? Yes, sir. We are to walk by faith, not by sight. Gehazi is walking by sight, not by faith. Not counting the blessing that he had. He's with the prophet. Look, he's the right-hand man, the servant of the prophet of God during this tremendous period of an outpouring of God's blessings upon these people. And he doesn't see it. Well, again, we mentioned the prophets were in want. They needed more room. And so they have a plan to go down to the Jordan and cut down some trees and build a better place. Well, as one of the prophets is down there, he's cutting a tree. The iron head slips off and falls into the water. He says, alas, it was borrowed. The word there literally is begged. He wasn't in a position to pay back what was lost. And so he's grieved very, very heavily about this loss. Elisha says, where did it fall? Well, it fell over there. So he takes a stick, throws it in, and the iron head floats, goes over and gets it. So again, in a small thing, the Lord is providing for his people, even in something so small as that. Now, we do have to realize that iron back then was much more valuable than we would think of it. And then we have the story of the Shunammite's land restored. We see the king. We don't know if it's Jehoram, but most likely he's asking Gehazi. This would have been before. The chronology here is not highly critical, but before he was leprous. King is curious about what great things that Elisha had done. Tell me about them. And so he does. And he's telling him about the Shunammite woman. And while he's telling her, she shows up after the famine of 7 years. And he says, this is her. She's asking for her land. And so the king gives that land back to her. All right. We'll begin with lesson 7 on Wednesday evening.